Military conscription, said Ronald Reagan in 1979, rests on the assumption that your kids belong to the state. That assumption isn't a new one. The Nazis thought it was a great idea. The following year, in a speech at Louisiana State University, Reagan added, I oppose registration for the draft because I believe the security of freedom can best be achieved by security through freedom. The all-voluntary force is based on the sound and historic American principle of voluntary commitment to defense of freedom. The United States of America believes a free people do not have to be coerced in defending their country or their values, and that the principle of freedom is the best and only foundation upon which a defense of freedom can be made. My vision of a secure America is based on my belief that freedom calls forth the best in the human spirit, and that the defense of freedom can and will best be made out of love of country, a love that needs no coercion. Out of such a love, a real security will develop, because in the final analysis, the free human heart and spirit are the best and most reliable defense. In late 1814, fearing that conscription was about to come to America, Daniel Webster delivered a stirring speech against it on the House floor. Webster served for many years in both the House and the Senate, and he held the office of Secretary of State in both the early 1840s and the early 1850s. Webster's belief in a strong central government made his words against the draft all the more striking. Where is it written in the Constitution, he demanded, in what article or section is it contained, that you may take children from their parents and parents from their children, and compel them to fight the battles of any war in which the folly or the wickedness of government may engage it? The draft was irreconcilable with both the principles of a free society and the provisions of the Constitution. In granting Congress the power to raise armies, Webster explained, the people have granted all the means which are ordinary and usual, and which are consistent with the liberties and security of the people themselves, and they have granted no others. A free government with arbitrary means to administer it is a contradiction. A free government without adequate provisions for personal security is an absurdity. A free government with an uncontrolled power of military conscription is a solecism at once the most ridiculous and abominable that ever entered into the head of man. Webster was right, both morally and constitutionally. Nowhere in the Constitution is the federal government given the power to conscript citizens. The power to raise armies is not a power to force people into the army. As Webster put it, I almost disdain to go to quotations and references to prove that such an abominable doctrine has no foundation in the Constitution of the country. It is enough to know that that instrument was intended as the basis of a free government, and that the power contended for is incompatible with any notion of personal liberty. An attempt to maintain this doctrine upon the provisions of the Constitution is an exercise of perverse ingenuity to extract slavery from substance of a free government. He continued, Congress having, by the Constitution, a power to raise armies, the Secretary of War contends that no restraint is to be imposed on the exercise of this power, except such as is expressly stated in the written letter of the instrument. In other words, that Congress may execute its powers by any means it chooses, unless such means are particularly prohibited. But the general nature and object of the Constitution impose as rigid a restriction on the means of exercising power as could be done by the most explicit injunctions. It is the first principle applicable to such a case that no construction shall be admitted which impairs the general nature and character of the instrument. A free constitution of government is to be construed upon free principles, and every branch of its provisions is to receive such an interpretation as is full of its general spirit. No means are to be taken by implication, which would strike us absurdly if expressed. And what would have been more absurd than for this constitution to have said that to secure the great blessings of liberty, it gave to government uncontrolled power of military conscription? Yet such is the absurdity which it is made to exhibit under the commentary of the Secretary of War. Lesser forms of the draft, such as compulsory national service, are based on the same unacceptable premise. Young people are not raw material to be employed by the political class on behalf of whatever fashionable political, military, or social cause catches its fancy. In a free society, their lives are not the playthings of government. One of the most contentious issues in our public life over the past 3.5 decades has been abortion. As a physician, and in particular as an obstetrician who has delivered over 4,000 babies, I have always had a special interest in the subject of abortion. When I studied medicine at Duke Medical School from 1957 to 1961, the subject was never raised. By the time of my medical residency at the University of Pittsburgh in the mid-1960s, though, wholesale defiance of the laws against abortion was taking place in various parts of the country, including my own. Residents were encouraged to visit various operating rooms in order to observe the procedures that were being done. One day, I walked into an operating room without knowing what I was walking into, and the doctors were in the middle of performing a C-section. It was actually an abortion by hysterotomy. The woman was probably 6 months along in her pregnancy, and the child she was carrying weighed over 2 pounds. At that time, doctors were not especially sophisticated, for lack of a better term, when it came to killing the baby prior to delivery. So they went ahead with delivery and put the baby in a bucket in the corner of the room. The baby tried to breathe and tried to cry, and everyone in the room pretended the baby wasn't there. I was deeply shaken by this experience, and it hit me at that moment just how important the life issue was. I have heard the arguments in favor of abortion many times, and they have always disturbed me deeply. A popular academic argument for abortion demands that we think of the child in the womb as a parasite that the woman has the right to expel from her body. But the same argument justifies outright infanticide, since it applies just as well to an infant outside the womb. Newborns require even more attention and care, and in that sense are even more parasitic. If we can be so callous as to refer to a growing child in a mother's womb as a parasite, I fear for our country's future all the more. Whether it is war or abortion, we conceal the reality of violent acts through linguistic contrivances meant to devalue human lives we find inconvenient. Dead civilians become collateral damage, are ignored altogether, or are rationalized away on the Leninist grounds that to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs. The Apostle Paul, on the other hand, condemned the idea that we should do evil that good may come. People ask an expectant mother how her baby is doing. They do not ask how her fetus is doing, or her blob of tissue, or her parasite. But that is what her baby becomes as soon as the child is declared to be unwanted. In both cases, we try to make human life into something less than human, simply according to our will. When Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973, striking down abortion laws all over the country, even some supporters of abortion were embarrassed by the decision as a matter of constitutional law. John Hart Eli, for instance, wrote in the Yale Law Review, "What is frightening about Roe is that this super-protected right is not inferable from the language of the Constitution. The framers' thinking respecting the specific problem in issue, any general value derivable from the provisions they included, or the nation's governmental structure." The decision, he said, is not constitutional law and gives almost no sense of an obligation to try to be. The federal government should not play any role in the abortion issue, according to the Constitution. Apart from waiting forever for Supreme Court justices who will rule in accordance with the Constitution, however, Americans who care about our fundamental law and or are concerned about abortion do have some legislative recourse. Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution gives Congress the power to strip the federal courts, including the Supreme Court, of jurisdiction over broad categories of cases. In the wake of the 1857 Dred Scott decision, abolitionists spoke of depriving the courts of jurisdiction in cases dealing with slavery. The courts were stripped of authority over Reconstruction policy in the late 1860s. If the federal courts refused to abide by the Constitution, the Congress should employ this constitutional remedy. By a simple majority, Congress could strip the federal courts of jurisdiction over abortion, thereby overturning the obviously unconstitutional Roe. At that point, the issue would revert to the states, where it constitutionally belongs, since no appeal to federal courts on the matter could be heard. I have proposed exactly this in H.R. 300. Let us remember, though, that the law can do only so much. The law isn't what allowed abortion. Abortions were already being done in the 1960s against the law. The courts came along and conformed to the social and moral changes that were taking place in society. Law reflects the morality of the people. Ultimately, law or no law, it is going to be up to us as parents, as clergy, and as citizens in the way we raise our children, how we interact and talk with our friends and neighbors, and the good example we give to bring about changes to our culture toward greater respect for life. To those who argue that we cannot allow the states to make decisions on abortion since some will make the wrong ones, I reply that that is an excellent argument for world government. For how can we allow individual countries to decide on abortion or other moral issues if some may make the wrong decisions? Yet the dangers of a world government surely speak for themselves. Let us therefore adopt the constitutional position, one that is achievable and can yield good results, but that shuns the utopian idea that all evil can be eradicated. The Founding Fathers' approach will not solve all problems, and it will not be perfect, but anyone expecting perfection in this world is going to be consistently disappointed. The same holds true for issues like prayer in schools. Such issues were never meant to be decided by federal judges. The whole point of the American Revolution was to vindicate the principle of local self-government. The British had denied that the colonial legislatures were exclusively endowed with the power to make political decisions for their peoples. The colonists, on the other hand, insisted that they would be governed only by their elected representatives. That remained the operative principle in the Articles of Confederation, as well as the Constitution. Local legislatures are presumed to hold authority, except in areas in which they have expressly given up that authority. We have come to consider it normal for 9 judges in Washington to decide on social policies that affect every neighborhood, family, and individual in America. One side of the debate hopes the 9 will impose one set of values, and the other side favors a different set. The underlying premise that this kind of monolith is desirable, or that no alternative is possible, is never examined, or at least not nearly as often as it should be. The Founding Fathers did not intend for every American neighborhood to be exactly the same, a totalitarian impulse if there ever was one, or that disputes over competing values should be decided by federal judges. This is the constitutional approach to deciding all issues that are not spelled out explicitly in our founding document. Let neighbors and localities govern themselves. The Founding Fathers would be astonished to observe how politicized our society has become, with every matter on which people differ becoming a federal issue to be resolved in Washington. Jefferson warned, "When all government, domestic and foreign, in little as in great things, shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless the checks provided of one government on another, and will become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we separated." Are we listening? In short, just as we should reject empire abroad, we should also reject it at home. One-size-fits-all social policy, dictated by unelected judges from an imperial capital, is not the system Americans signed on for when they ratified the Constitution. And they have never formally sanctioned such a thing. Some people claim that the doctrine of states' rights, one of Thomas Jefferson's central principles, has become responsible for racism. But racism, a disorder of the heart, can become entrenched in any political environment, whether highly centralized like Hitler's Germany or highly decentralized like our own country. In Mein Kampf, Hitler spoke with delight of the process by which governments around the world were becoming more centralized, with states and local governments having less and less power. It was a trend he wanted to see continue in Germany in order to build a powerful national Reich in which the central government could impose its will without having to worry about recalcitrant states. Hitler wrote, "National socialism as a matter of principle must lay claim to the right to force its principles on the whole German nation without consideration of previous federated state boundaries and to educate in its ideas and conceptions. Just as the churches do not feel bound and limited by political boundaries, no more does the National Socialist idea feel limited by the individual state territories of our fatherland. The National Socialist doctrine is not the servant of individual federated states, but shall someday become the master of the German nation. No form of political organization, therefore, is immune to cruel abuses like the Jim Crow laws, whereby government sets out to legislate on how groups of human beings are allowed to interact with one another. Peaceful civil disobedience to unjust laws, which I support with every fiber of my being, can sometimes be necessary at any level of government. It falls upon the people, in the last resort, to stand against injustice, no matter where it occurs. In the long run, the only way racism can be overcome is through the philosophy of individualism, which I have promoted throughout my life. Our rights come to us not because we belong to some group, but our rights come to us as individuals, and it is as individuals that we should judge one another. Racism is a particularly odious form of collectivism whereby individuals are treated not on their merits, but on the basis of group identity. Nothing in my political philosophy, which is the exact opposite of the racial totalitarianism of the 20th century, gives aid or comfort to such thinking. To the contrary, my philosophy of individualism is the most radical intellectual challenge to racism ever posed. Government exacerbates racial thinking and undermines individualism because its very existence encourages people to organize along racial lines in order to lobby for benefits for their group. That lobbying, in turn, creates animosity and suspicion among all groups, each of which believes that it is getting less of its fair share than the others. Instead, we should quit thinking in terms of race. Yes, in 2008 it is still necessary to say that we should stop thinking in terms of race and recognize that freedom and prosperity benefit all Americans. As Thomas Sowell points out, lobbyists for various racial groups will spend all their time trying to enact programs that specifically help their own group, even though that group would reap far more benefit from advancing economic freedom in general. He gives the example of taxi licensing restrictions, a government policy that disproportionately hurts blacks, but since it is not thought of as a racial issue per se, racial pressure groups do absolutely nothing to overturn it. That's another reason we should stop thinking in terms of race. Consider Sowell. Politically, however, it makes far more sense for a black leader to fight tooth and nail for 100 more CETA, Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, jobs in the Philadelphia ghetto than to fight for an end to taxi licensing restrictions, even though the latter would probably mean thousands more jobs for blacks, jobs with far higher pay than CETA jobs and of permanent duration. Ghetto jobs are an earmarked benefit, however few, tenuous and low-paid. Benefits to blacks as members of the general public are no feather in a black leader's cap, even if blacks are benefited more than others by gaining access that was nearly impossible for them before. As I discuss in Chapter 5, the federal war on drugs has wrought disproportionate harm on minority communities. Allowing for states' rights here would surely be an improvement, for the states could certainly do a better and more sensible job than the federal government has been doing if they were free to decide the issue for themselves. And although people studying my record will discover how consistent I have been over the years, they will uncover one major shift. In recent years, I have dropped my support for the federal death penalty. It is a dangerous power for the federal government to have, and it is exercised in a discriminatory way. If you are poor and black, you are much more likely to receive this punishment. We should not think in terms of whites, blacks, Hispanics, and other such groups. That kind of thinking only divides us. The only us versus them thinking in which we might indulge is the people, all the people, versus the government, which loots and lies to us all, threatens our liberties, and shreds our Constitution. That's not a white or black issue. That's an American issue, and it's one on which Americans of all races can unite in a spirit of goodwill. That may be why polls in 2007 found ours the most popular Republican campaign among black voters. If our government were scrupulously faithful to the Constitution, we would not need to be especially concerned when a person who represents a philosophy different from our own takes political office. Our Constitution delegates relatively few tasks to the federal government, so it should almost be a matter of indifference who was elected. We wouldn't have to worry that a social policy of which we disapproved would be imposed on our neighborhood at the whim of the new president and his court appointees, or that more of our money would be stolen to fund yet another government boondoggle. And we would also be spared the spectacle of countless American individuals and corporations frantically donating to candidates for political office during election years in order to reserve a place on the federal gravy train if their favorite should win. I've often cautioned conservatives who are tempted to give more power to the federal government in general, or the executive branch in particular, that those individual powers be available to whoever takes office next, and that person may not be to your liking. I now find myself offering the same words of caution to liberals. Whatever temptation you may have to exceed the powers granted under the Constitution, understand that you are opening a Pandora's box. Once we lose our respect for the Constitution and begin interpreting it so that it happens to permit our pet programs, we have no right to be surprised when our political opponents come along with their own ideas for interpreting the Constitution loosely. To be sure, the U.S. Constitution is not perfect. Few human contrivances are. But it's a pretty good one, I think, and it defines and limits the scope of government. When we get into the habit of disregarding it or, what is the same thing, interpreting certain key phrases so broadly as to allow the federal government to do whatever it wants, we do so at our peril. We will wind up with a situation like the one we face right now that few Americans are happy with. I do not believe that most Americans want to continue down this path. Undeclared wars without end, more and more police state measures, and a Constitution that may as well not exist. But this is not a fated existence. We do not have to live in this kind of America. It is not too late to rally and recall our people to the Constitution, the rule of law, and our traditional American republic. Chapter 4. Economic Freedom. Economic freedom is based on a simple moral rule. Everyone has a right to his or her life and property, and no one has the right to deprive anyone of these things. To some extent, everyone accepts this principle. For instance, anyone going to his neighbor's home and taking his money at gunpoint, regardless of all the wonderful selfless things he promised to do with it, would be promptly arrested as a thief. But for some reason, it is considered morally acceptable when government does that very thing. We have allowed government to operate according to its own set of moral rules. Frédéric Bastiat, one of the great political and economic writers of all time, called this legal plunder. Bastiat identified three approaches we could take to such plunder. 1. The few plunder the many. 2. Everybody plunders everybody. 3. Nobody plunders anybody. We presently follow option number 2. Everyone seeks to use government to enrich himself at his neighbor's expense. That's why Bastiat called the state the great fiction through which everybody endeavors to live at the expense of everybody else. Now, here's a radical idea. What if we pursued option number 3 and decided to stop robbing one another? What if we decided that there was a better, more humane way for people to interact with each other? What if we stopped doing things we would consider morally outrageous if done by private individuals, but that we consider perfectly all right when carried out by government in the name of public policy? By legal plunder, Bastiat meant any use of government that enriched one group of people at the expense of another, and that would be illegal if private individuals tried to carry it out themselves. He was not speaking only or even primarily about programs that are supposed to help the poor. Bastiat was a keen enough observer of the human condition to realize that people of all classes are happy to use the machinery of state, if they can get away with it, to benefit themselves instead of earning their way in the world honestly. The rich are more than happy to secure for themselves a share of the loot, for example, in the form of subsidized low-interest loans, as with the Export-Import Bank, bailouts when their risky loans go sour, or regulatory schemes that hurt their smaller competitors or make it harder for new ones to enter an industry. Of course, industry leaders will portray such regulation as being for the public good, and media outlets, inclined to give all regulation the benefit of the doubt, will do their best to make sure Americans buy it. This simple idea that government should stay out of the looting business and leave people to their own pursuits has had great moral appeal throughout U.S. history. The American poet Walt Whitman urged that no man's benefit be achieved at the expense of his neighbors, while mere politicians, in their narrow minds, are sweating and fuming with their complicated statutes. This one single rule is enough to form the starting point of all that is necessary in government, to make no more laws than those useful for preventing a man or body of men from infringing on the rights of other men. Likewise, William Leggett, a Jacksonian editorial writer, believed that government should be restricted to the making of general laws, uniform and universal in their operation, for the sole purpose of protecting people and their property. Governments have no right to interfere with the pursuits of individuals, as guaranteed by those general laws, by offering encouragements and granting privileges to any particular class of industry or any select bodies of men, inasmuch as all classes of industry and all men are equally important to the general welfare and equally entitled to protection. Whenever a government assumes the power of discriminating between the different classes of the community, it becomes, in effect, the arbiter of their prosperity and exercises a power not contemplated by any intelligent people in delegating their sovereignty to their rulers. It then becomes the great regulator of the profits of every species of industry and reduces men from a dependence on their own exertions to a dependence on the caprices of their government. Governments possess no delegated right to tamper with individual industry a single hair's breadth beyond what is essential to protect the rights of person and property. In the exercise of this power of intermeddling with the private pursuits and individual occupations of the citizen, a government may at pleasure elevate one class and depress another. It may one day legislate exclusively for the farmer, the next for the mechanic, and the third for the manufacturer, who all thus become the mere puppets of legislative cobbling and tinkering instead of independent citizens relying on their own resources for their prosperity. It assumes the functions which belong alone to an overruling providence and affects to become the universal dispenser of good and evil. Consider a single, almost trivial example of government favoritism: sugar quotas. The United States government limits the amount of sugar that can be imported from around the world. Those quotas make sugar more expensive for all Americans, since they now have fewer choices as a result of diminished competition. The quotas also put at a competitive disadvantage all those businesses that use sugar to produce their own products. That's one reason that American colas use corn syrup instead of sugar. American sugar, thanks to the quotas, is simply too expensive. And it's also a reason that colas in other countries taste so much better. The number of people who work in the American sugar industry is, of course, very small when compared to the American population as a whole. How, then, do they manage to get a government policy enacted that harms the vast bulk of their fellow citizens? The answer is that the benefits are concentrated while the costs are dispersed. The small number of people who work in the sugar industry benefits substantially from the quota. It makes sense for the sugar industry to employ professional lobbyists first to get and then to continue this concentrated flow of benefits. On the other hand, since the costs of these policies are spread out across the entire American people, the cost to any one purchaser of sugar or products containing sugar is very minor. It makes no sense for the general public to marshal resources to lobby for the repeal of the program. It is hardly worth their time even to be informed about it. Each consumer might pay an extra $50 to $100 per year thanks to the program, a pittance compared to what industry earns from it, and not nearly enough to make it worthwhile to hire lobbyists or launch any serious effort to abolish it. And so the tendency is for this fleecing of the public to get worse and worse. The concentrated benefits it brings are too hard to resist, but the dispersed costs are too small to justify any effort against it. Multiply this modest example by about a million to account for the countless other predatory schemes that special interests have imposed on our economy, and you have some idea of the impact of legal plunder. If we believe in liberty, we must also remember what William Graham Sumner called the forgotten man. The forgotten man is the one whose labor is exploited in order to benefit whatever political cause catches the government's fancy. The type and formula of most schemes of philanthropy or humanitarianism is this. A and B put their heads together to decide what C shall be made to do for D. The radical vice of all these schemes, from a sociological point of view, is that C is not allowed a voice in the matter, and his position, character, and interests, as well as the ultimate effects on society through C's interests, are entirely overlooked. I call C the forgotten man. They therefore ignore entirely the source from which they must draw all the energy which they employ in their remedies, and they ignore all the effects on other members of society than the ones they have in view. They are always under the dominion of the superstition of government, and forgetting that a government produces nothing at all, they leave out of sight the first fact to be remembered in all social discussion, that the state cannot get a cent for any man without taking it from some other man, and this latter must be a man who has produced and saved it. This latter is the forgotten man. Once government does become involved in something, intellectual and institutional inertia tends to keep it there for good. People lose their political imagination. It becomes impossible to conceive of dealing with the matter in any other way. Repealing the new bureaucracy becomes unthinkable. Mythology about how terrible things were in the old days becomes the conventional wisdom. Meanwhile, the bureaucracy itself, with a vested interest in maintaining itself and increasing its funding, employs all the resources it can to ensuring that it gets a bigger budget next year, regardless of its performance. In fact, the worse it does, the more funding it is likely to get. Exactly the opposite of what happens in the private sector, in which those who successfully meet the needs of their fellow men are rewarded with profits, and those who poorly anticipate consumer demand are punished with losses. Take arts funding, for example. Some Americans appear to believe that there would be no arts in America were it not for the National Endowment for the Arts, NEA, an institution created in 1965. They cannot imagine things being done any other way, even though they were done another way throughout our country's existence and throughout most of mankind's history. While the government requested $121 million for the NEA in 2006, private donations to the arts totaled $2.5 billion that year, dwarfing the NEA budget. The NEA represents a tiny fraction of all arts funding, a fact few Americans realize. Freedom works, after all, and that money is almost certainly better spent than government money. NEA funds go not necessarily to the best artists, but to people who happen to be good at filling out government grant applications. I have my doubts that the same people populate both categories. Alexis de Tocqueville was very impressed when he visited our country in the 19th century to see how many voluntary associations Americans had formed in order to achieve common goals. The political associations which exist in the United States are only a single feature in the myths of the immense assemblage of associations in that country, he wrote. Wherever, at the head of some new undertaking, you see the government in France or a man of rank in England, in the United States, you will be sure to find an association. De Tocqueville admired the extreme skill with which the inhabitants of the United States succeed in proposing a common object to the exertions of a great many men and in getting them voluntarily to pursue it. That may be all well and good for the arts and the like, some may say, but private efforts could never substitute for gigantic government budgets for various forms of welfare. But private assistance would not need to match these budgets dollar for dollar. As much as 70% of welfare budgets have been eaten up by bureaucracy. Moreover, government programs are far more easily abused, and the money they dispense more readily becomes a destructive habit than with more local or private forms of assistance. Why would we expect a system based on legal plunder, as ours is, to be a net benefit to the poor or middle class in whose name so many government schemes are enacted? Every one of the special benefits, on behalf of which hundreds of millions of dollars are expended on lobbyists every year, makes goods more expensive, companies less efficient and competitive, and the economy more sluggish. Given that the politically influential and well-connected, neither of which includes the middle class or the poor, are the ones who tend to win privileges and loot from government, I do not understand why we take for granted that the net result of all this looting is good for those who are lower on the economic ladder. And when the loot is paid for by printing money and causing inflation, which, as I show in the chapter on money, disproportionately harms the most vulnerable, the suggestion that the least prosperous are helped by all this intervention collapses into outright farce. To get an appreciation for the difference between public and private administration in terms of bureaucracy and cost-effectiveness, consider this. The Brookings Institution's John Chubb once investigated the number of bureaucrats working in the central administration offices of the New York City public schools. Six telephone calls finally yielded someone who knew the answer, but that person was not allowed to disclose it. Another six calls later, Chubb had at last pinned down someone who knew the answer and could tell him what it was. There were 6,000 bureaucrats working in the central office. Then Chubb called the Archdiocese of New York to find out the figure there. The city's Catholic schools educated one-fifth as many students as did the government-run schools. Chubb's first telephone call was taken by someone who did not know the answer. Here we go again, he thought. But after a moment she said, "Wait a minute, let me count." Her answer? 26. Now, whatever its moral and philosophical attractiveness, the free economy I have just proposed, in which no one is allowed to use government power to loot anyone else, is sometimes criticized as a pro-business philosophy that favors the well-to-do, This criticism could not be more off target. As I have said, businessmen, too, want special favors from government and lobby energetically for all kinds of wealth transfers to themselves. Very rarely does a business owner come to my congressional office to congratulate me on my fidelity to the Constitution. They come by because they want something, and what they want is usually not authorized by the Constitution. I do not claim that businessmen as a class are underhanded or wicked, since I do not believe in making prejudicial generalizations about any group. I am saying only that they are just as likely as anyone else to favor government intervention on their behalf. I have nothing but respect and admiration for honest businessmen. Their contributions to our society are indispensable and almost completely unsung. The entrepreneur who risks everything he has in order to realize a dream and improve our lives in the process is engaged in a worthy and honorable pursuit that earns him precious little respect in our society. Economic historian Burton Folsom makes a useful distinction between market entrepreneurs, who grow wealthy when the public freely purchases what they have to sell, and political entrepreneurs, who grow wealthy because government cripples their competitors or grants them a monopoly. Folsom even shows that some of our most effective and admirable businessmen have succeeded in the face of rivals who enjoyed government subsidies and privileges. I cannot finish a discussion of looting without mentioning the income tax. In another chapter, I explain my opposition to the military draft, an institution based on the idea that the government owns its citizens and may direct their destinies against their will. The income tax implies the same thing. Government owns you and graciously allows you to keep whatever percentage of the fruits of your labor it chooses. Such an idea is incompatible with the principles of a free society. Robert Nozick, the renowned 20th-century political philosopher, minced no words when it came to the taxation of earnings from labor. How, he demanded to know, was this any different from forced labor? In America, the average citizen, in effect, does unremunerated work for the government for the equivalent of 6 months out of the year. People who favor this system should be honest about what they are saying. We have the right to force you to work against your will. Strip away the civics class platitudes about contributions to society, which are mere obfuscations designed to engineer the people's consent to the system, and that is what the income tax amounts to. Frank Chodorov, a great stalwart of the old right, put it this way: the citizen is sovereign only when he can retain and enjoy the fruits of his labor. If the government has first claim on his property, he must learn to genuflect before it. When the right of property is abrogated, all the other rights of the individual are undermined, and to speak of the sovereign citizen who has no absolute right of property is to talk nonsense. It's like saying that the slave is free because he is allowed to do anything he wants to do, even vote if he wish, except to own what he produces. With a consensus not yet established behind the abolition of the income tax, although I have never ceased voting and speaking on behalf of such an outcome, I have done my best to eliminate income and other taxation in as many specific cases as possible, in order at least to make dents in the edifice in the meantime. For instance, I have proposed for all those whose income consists largely of tips that income in the form of tips be exempt from income taxation. I have proposed that America's teachers be granted tax credits, thereby increasing their salaries. I have proposed that people with terminal illnesses be exempt from Social Security taxes while they struggle for their lives. There is surely no moral justification for taxing people who are trying to maintain their very lives. What we should work toward, however, is abolishing the income tax and replacing it not with a national sales tax, but with nothing. Right now, the federal government is funded by excise taxes, corporate income taxes, payroll taxes, the individual income tax, and miscellaneous other sources. Abolishing the income tax on individuals would cut government revenue by about 40%. I have heard the breathless claims about how radical that is, and compared to the trivial changes we are accustomed to seeing in government, I suppose it is. But in absolute terms, is it really so radical? In order to imagine what it would be like to live in a country with a federal budget 40% lower than the federal budget of 2007, it would be necessary to go all the way back to 1997. Would it really be so hard to imagine living in 1997 again? In return, we would have an economy so robust and dynamic that it would doubtless shatter even my own optimistic expectations, and we would once and for all have repudiated the totalitarian assumptions at the heart of the income tax. How, by the way, did we ever let ourselves be talked into such a thing? The income tax was first proposed for several reasons. The tariff, from which the federal government received most of its funding, was for a variety of reasons bringing in a decreased revenue. At the same time, federal expenditures were going up, thanks in part to an increase in the military budget. An alternative had to be found. At the time, many Americans viewed the tariff as an unfair tax that burdened them as consumers and benefited big business by sheltering it from foreign competition. A tax on incomes, the argument went, would at last force the rich to pay their share. And that's just how the income tax was pitched to the people. Tax relief for you in the form of lower tariffs and a tax increase for the rich. Do not worry, people were told. Only the richest of the rich will ever pay the income tax. That phony promise didn't last long. Within a few years, tax rates had shot through the roof, and classes of people who had thought they would never be taxed found themselves paying as well. And by the 1920s, the tariff was raised again anyway, so the people wound up getting the worst of both worlds. Now, plenty of politicians talk a good game about low taxes, and even some claim to want to decrease spending as well. Few seem to mean it, if their voting records are any indication. But if we want more economic freedom and a healthy and robust economy, serious inroads need to be made into federal spending. Otherwise, tax cuts will simply lead to more borrowing, more inflation, and the continued decline of the dollar. As I write, we are paying about $1.4 billion every day just for the interest on the national debt. Because our government refuses to live within its means, every single day we spend $1.4 billion and receive absolutely nothing in return. But instead of talking seriously about how we might restore fiscal sanity to the federal budget, the political establishment tries to distract us with phony issues like the debate over earmarks, legislative provisions that direct federal money to local projects. One need not look very hard to find examples of abuses of earmarks. But even if all earmarks were eliminated, we would not necessarily save a single penny in the federal budget. Earmarks are funded from spending levels that have been determined before a single earmark is agreed to, so spending levels remain the same with or without earmarks. By eliminating earmarks designated by members of Congress, all we would accomplish would be to transfer the funding decision process to federal bureaucrats and away from elected representatives. In a flawed system, earmarks can at least allow residents of congressional districts to have a greater role in allocating federal funds, their tax dollars, than if the money is apportioned behind locked doors by bureaucrats. The real problem, and one that was unfortunately not addressed in 2007's earmark dispute, is the size of the federal government and the amount of money we are spending in these appropriation bills. Cutting even $1 million from an appropriations bill that spends hundreds of billions will make no appreciable difference in the size of government, which is doubtless why politicians and the media are so eager to have us waste our time on this. There is a danger that supporters of limited government will focus on this trivial question and neglect the much more important and difficult battle of returning the federal government to spending levels more in line with its constitutional functions. Without taking a serious look at the actual total spending in these appropriations bills, we will miss the real threat to our economic security. The kind of spending cuts we obviously need will not be easy, since our government has encouraged so many Americans to become dependent on federal programs. These programs cannot survive much longer without a financial collapse. Our national debt, now $9 trillion, does not include the unfunded liabilities to programs like Social Security and Medicare that will come due in the coming decades to the tune of another $50 trillion. It is simply impossible to fulfill those promises. The level of taxation necessary to fund a figure like that would destroy the American economy and dramatically shrink the productive base from which those funds could be drawn. David Walker, the Comptroller General at the U.S. Government Accountability Office, tells us that Social Security and Medicare are headed for disaster because of demographic trends and rising health care costs. The number of younger taxpayers for each older retiree will continue to decline. The demand for free prescription drugs under Medicare will explode. If present trends continue, by 2040, the entire federal budget will be consumed by Social Security and Medicare. 40% of our entire private sector output will need to go to just these two programs. The only options for balancing the budget would be cutting total federal spending by about 60% or doubling federal taxes. Furthermore, Walker asserts, we cannot grow our way out of this problem. Faster economic growth can only delay the inevitable hard choices. To close the long-term entitlement gap, the U.S. economy would have to grow by double digits every year for the next 75 years. Issues like these are predictably portrayed as contests between generous souls who want to provide for their fellow men on one hand, and misers and misanthropes who care nothing for the suffering of their fellow citizens on the other. I should not have to point out that this is an absurd caricature. The fact is, we do not have the resources to sustain these programs in the long run. There is no way around this simple fact, a fact politicians consistently ignore or conceal in order to tell Americans what they think their fellow countrymen want to hear. In the short run, in order to provide for those we have taught to be dependent, such programs could survive. My own suggestion is to fund this transition period by scaling back our unsustainable overseas commitments, saving hundreds of billions from the nearly $1 trillion our empire is costing us every year, and in the process, streamlining our overstretched military and making it more efficient and effective. That is the only place where we can easily save money, applying some of the savings to these domestic programs and the rest to debt reduction. Our out-of-control welfare state also helps account for the scope of our illegal immigration problem. When you subsidize something, you get more of it. And by offering free medical care and other services, as well as the prospect of amnesty, we get more illegal immigration. Meanwhile, hospitals have begun closing as our states and localities struggle to pay the bill.